Welcome to Beth Tikkun and this series on the spiritual seasons of the year. This week, we are in portion Kitisa, from the middle of Exodus 30 through chapter 34. Kitisa is really a massively important portion with a great many events. We'll take some time today to walk through them and a little bit more than we do with some other portions and have a little bit of commentary along the way, and then branch into some other topics. So the portion starts out with the rather boring-seeming procedure to take the census. Now, we know nothing in the Torah is boring, right? If we're bored, it's because we aren't seeing what's there. We'll go a bit deeper with the census later in the teaching. For now, let's just point out that the census commandment is where the name Kitisa comes from. The sentence here uses an idiom of lifting the head to be counted in the census. Kitisa means when you lift. And the literal translation of the first idea here would be something like when you lift the head of the children of Israel to number them. Every man shall give a ransom for his soul to the Lord. The ransom or atonement is set at half a shekel for each man. It would seem that each man throws in a half shekel, and it is the half shekels that are counted rather than the people themselves. The text then goes on to describe the bronze basin or laver, which I called a kinor in a previous teaching. It's kior, not kinor. This is followed by recipes for the anointing oil and incense, which finish out the instructions for the tabernacle. God then tells Moses that he has called Bezalel of the tribe of Judah and filled him with the Spirit of God to be able to do the work required for constructing the tabernacle and all its furnishings. And he has called Aholiab of the tribe of Dan with Bezalel. So these two are a pair, one from the tribe of Judah and one from Dan. God then repeats the Sabbath commandment as if to say, and all this work you're going to be doing with the tabernacle, don't break the Sabbath. And we're going to see the Sabbath commandment repeated yet again a little bit later in the portion. Before that, though, comes the tragedy of the golden calf. Although God had already clearly instructed the people to not make idols, the people seem to be acting out of ignorance here as they try to understand how to worship God in the absence of Moses, who can help them understand the ways of the Lord. It's God who they are trying to worship. Most of what they know about worship at this point comes from Egypt, where they would fashion a physical object to act as a channel of worship of a god. They have the desire to worship the true God who took them out of Egypt, but they can't imagine that there's another way to do that than what they learned to do in Egypt. So they make an idol through which they try to worship the true God. And they have apparently also learned in Egypt that such idolatrous worship should also be connected to sexual immorality. So they seem to have done that too. It's a real mess. But one thing the incident shows us is how radically different God's ways are than man's ways. What man thought to do and developed in Egypt, that's not God's way. So God tells Moses what the people have done below, right? They're up on the mountain, and God is giving him the instructions for the tabernacle, and he says, yeah, you better go down. It would seem God purposed to wipe out Israel at this point. But he doesn't want to do that with Moses looking on, which is an interesting lesson in God's character. I thought it's an interesting verse where God says, let me alone, as if God has to tell a human being, leave me alone. He says, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you. I mean, maybe what God is really doing is just letting Moses know his thoughts so that Moses will then intercede for the people. And so Moses does that on behalf of the people. We can learn from what he does, what Moses does in that moment. First, he appeals to God's reputation among the nations. He says that the nations will think God brought them out of Egypt to kill them in the mountains. And he also appeals to God's relationship with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When we see doom approaching, we can also appeal to God's reputation and to his relationships with the patriarchs and our own ancestors. You know, God, you had such a relationship with grandmother so-and-so, and just remember her at this time for me on my behalf. The Haftorah for this portion in Ezekiel makes this point that God is concerned for his name and will sometimes save the undeserving simply for the sake of protecting his name. The first verse of the Haftorah reads, "Therefore say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I am about to act, but for the sake of my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations to which you came." So that's in Ezekiel 36, the first verse of the Haftorah. With Moses, with his intercession on behalf of the people, God relents, and Moses goes down with the tablets. He picks up Joshua somewhere along the way, and when Moses sees with his own eyes what is happening among the people, he's so enraged that he shatters the tablets God had just inscribed with his own finger. Moses disciplines the people and asks for those on the Lord's side to rally to him. It is only Moses' own tribe, the Levites, that do so. And the Levites end up slaying 3,000 in Israel that day. And this action is connected to their elevation to service in Israel in the temple. Moses goes back up the mountain and continues to intercede for the people, asking that God either spare them or blot out his own name from God's book. God answers that he will blot out from his book whoever sinned against him. And then he sends a plague on the people. So we have yet more of Moses' intercession for the people a bit later in the chapter, a conversation that leads to Moses saying to God, "Please show me your glory." And it's a fascinating request that almost seems to not fit the situation. Moses sees the incident of the golden calf, and before that he hears God say that they are a stiff-necked people. At this point, Moses knows that he's in for a real challenge in leading his people. Moses' response to being presented with that challenge isn't, "God, please make me more powerful or make me wise to lead the people." He doesn't try to get out of it either. Instead, Moses' response is that he needs to know God better. It's like Moses has gotten to know God enough by this point to know that he really wanted to know him. He really wanted to know him. And that process should be happening in each of us. The more we see, the more we want to see of God. But think about what Moses has seen of God so far. It's been a lot of destruction in Egypt and even destruction in Moses' own people, the children of Israel. Yet in all those interactions with God up to this point, God's essence was leaking through to Moses, and Moses wanted to see more. There's a way to discipline, like God is disciplining in Egypt, like God is disciplining in the wilderness. There's a way to discipline in love and a way to discipline in mere anger. If we discipline in love, we actually end up drawing the one we are disciplining toward us. And this is what happens with Moses and God. God agrees to make all his goodness pass before Moses and says that he will proclaim his name, the Lord, the Tetragrammaton. But first, Moses has to go down to chisel new tablets like the first he broke. It's almost like God is giving Moses the chance to at least partly make right what he did in anger when he broke the first tablets. So Moses ascends with the new set. And only then, when Moses has had a chance to partly make right his action, God descends in a cloud and stands with Moses. And at some point, God puts Moses in the cleft of the rock and passes before him so that Moses can see his back. And God speaks out his name in the form of what Judaism calls the 13 attributes of mercy. It's a high point in the whole of the Bible. God then renews the covenant, connecting to this renewal several items, which we must conclude are very important due to this connection to the covenant renewal, right? There's this important thing that's just happened, and God chooses to connect to that just a couple of things. The first is the promise to drive out the inhabitants of Canaan. And so that's kind of the promise of future blessing. Okay, I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to overlook this. I'm going to bless you in the future. And the second thing he connects to this moment is the commandment to not make molten images, which seems quite appropriate here after the golden calf. And the third item connected to this important moment of covenant renewal is fascinatingly the reiteration of the Moedim, particularly the three pilgrimage festivals, and once more, the Sabbath. And we'll talk about why it might be that the Moedim of all things are among the few commandments connected to this covenant renewal in this transcendent moment when God reveals himself to a human being. Finally, as the portion ends, we read about the shining face of Moses, how his face would shine after he would talk with God, such that he felt the need to wear a veil after talking with God. So let's do some work now connecting this portion to the calendar. The first connection I'd like to make has to do with community. As the calendar draws to a close, we are functioning within a community as never before. Healing and maturity, the end of the calendar, you know, living as we're designed to live, is all about connecting to each other and serving each other in the very specific ways we're given to serve. There are several places in this portion that speak to being bound together in community. And so I think that's appropriate for this season. So the first one is the census. As we mentioned before, Kitisa means when you lift the head, when you lift the head to take a census, or we can say when you lift the head to reckon people as part of this community, this nation. Being counted in the census is an affirmation of your status as an Israelite, but it's more than that. The lifting of the head implies healing. So hear this. Being in community and healing are connected. And the opposite is also true. Being in sin and separation from community are connected. Sin makes your head drop, your face drop, and it makes you withdraw from people. The shame of falling cuts us off from others. We first see this literal connection of falling to sin in the text when Cain's offering is rejected and he is crestfallen. And God asks Cain, why are you angry and why has your face fallen? When a person's face falls, they are averting their eyes, right? They're looking away. They're not wanting their eyes to meet yours. If you find yourself or someone else pulling away from community, it's possible that deep sin is behind this disconnection and shame. In the same way that sin is connected to falling, raising up the face, raising up the head with a smile, right? Literally, we're raising our face when we smile. Have you ever thought of a smile that way? You're raising your face. And raising up the eyes to meet the eyes of others is related to healing and overcoming sin. So once again, lifting a head and being part of community and healing are like a package deal. They go together. So this lifting of the head is what this portion is about, being the name of the portion. But this is kind of a curious name for this portion. It's kind of a curious thing because we find here the incident of the golden calf, right? Well, that's a splitting with God. But then we also find God's revelation of himself to Moses here. So the fact that the title of the portion is related to the healing, right, the lifting of the head, rather than the falling, shows us where we should put our emphasis while reading this portion. We put it less on Israel's sin of the golden calf and more on the positives, like God's deep revelation of himself to a man. That's a lifting of the head. Another place we see this idea of community and unity here in this portion in regards to the census is in the idea of the half shekel. Many commentators make the case that a half shekel is incomplete, right? It's a half. It's not a whole. Seems a bit odd way to count a person with a half shekel. And so they go on to say that it is only in community that one's shekel is made whole. And Grant points out this story in the Gospels of Yeshua directing one of the apostles, maybe it was Peter, to go and fish for a fish, and he'll find a shekel with which he is to pay the tax for himself and for Yeshua, one shekel to pay for the two of them. Well, let's bring in the Moedim now under this point about maturity being linked to connection and community. So as I mentioned, the odd-seeming restatement in this portion of the Sabbath, yet again, along with the pilgrimage festivals, is connected here to God revealing himself to Moses and the renewal of the covenant with the nation. The text says, "You shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread as I commanded you." And on it goes. There's just one right after the next. No transition. So in other words, don't make another golden calf and keep the feast of unleavened bread. And then it goes on and describes the other pilgrimage festivals. So why are the Moedim included here? I think we underestimate the power of the Moedim, their ability to keep us centered and remembering, and their power to strongly unite a community. This is one place in the Torah where we can see just how important these appointed times are in God's mind and in his design for us. We have plenty of holidays nowadays, from President's Day to Valentine's Day. What we're talking about here is different. The Moedim will be the heartbeat of the world one day. So let me repeat something important that Robin Luton mentioned in her Torah portion conversation this week with Grant on the Torah Today Ministries website, TorahTodayMinistries.org. I'll give Grant a little plug there. She and Grant were discussing the golden calf and the idea that Israel somehow forgot. How could they do this golden calf so quickly? And they said, Grant said, well, they forgot. We can say that they forgot who they were and who God is and how we walk with him. And Robin said, as soon as we forget, we start to make idols in our life. The weekly Sabbath, right, that weekly Sabbath tugs us back into the reality of the spiritual realm. So for 6 days, our eyes and our ears are mostly filled with the mundane things of life. But the Sabbath, on the Sabbath, we're more focused on the spiritual realm than the mundane. We even cook ahead of time, right? We're getting that mundane stuff out of the way, and we don't focus on that on Saturday, on Friday evening to Saturday evening. The annual Moedim too, right? The ones that we find only on an annual basis, they also pull us back to the source of our blessing and the source of our salvation, right? And a lot of them are about bringing first fruits and gifts to God. It's another way to say, I depend on you, God. I don't depend on this world. I depend on you. And so they are partly designed for meeting with God so that he can do a work of growth in us, all of these annual Moedim, but they're also partly designed to make us remember. And the word remember is explicitly linked to the various Moedim. For Rosh Hashanah is one of the only things we're told about that day. Blow, you know, make a noise and remember. It doesn't even tell us what to remember. God is repeating the appointed times at this point of re-embracing Israel after their idolatry, because there's great power in the Moedim to recenter us in truth so that we won't stray with idolatry again. How are we going to be fixed in the truth so that we don't forget? And partly that happens through the Moedim, including the Sabbath and the annual Moedim, repeated here in this portion. So beyond the Moedim anchoring us in truth, I think we underestimate the power of God's appointed times to set a rhythm and unite people together. Think about how these three pilgrimage festivals unite the nation. Much planning throughout the year must go into these trips where they are connected in the heart of the nation at Jerusalem, the city of Shalom, Yerushalayim, completeness, wholeness. If you, I mean, Shalom is like pieces coming together to make a whole. If you are a farmer and you know you're going to have to, you know, be gone from your farm for a couple of weeks at certain points in the year for these pilgrimage festivals, you know that you will need to get the seeds into the ground by a certain time so that you can harvest by a certain time, so you can start out for Jerusalem with your first fruits in hand. You're doing all of your work with one eye always on these coming trips to meet with the God of the universe in the holy city of God. And it's exciting. You're looking forward to it. And two, in the process of meeting with him and bringing your offerings to him, you are united with the rest of the nation, the other tribes who live so far away from you that you would never see them if it weren't for these pilgrimage festivals, right? How are people from Naphtali gonna ever see people from Reuben, you know, if they're not brought together at these Moedim? Everyone is going to be planning around and planning for the Moedim. It's the pulse of the nation. So let's broaden this out a bit by bringing in an application to Yeshua here into the picture. Think now to a time after Yeshua returns and the world is at peace. In practical terms, how is it that we are going to be united across our vast distances and cultures, from Japan to California? Of course, first of all, we are united only by the blood of Yeshua. That's the foundation. But what are the vessels, like the practical physical vessels that we are given to express that unity? Well, the vessels are the commandments. And among those commandments, the Moedim have a special place of honor because of their power to unite across time and space. What if the people in Japan and China and Afghanistan and Syria and South Africa and France and the Americas were all sharing a sacred calendar that brings time into alignment for all of them, that brings business into alignment and travel into alignment, where all the employers in the world know that people will be resting and celebrating and cooking and traveling on certain days? It's one thing for a country to be in step like this. I mean, we can be in step like this for Thanksgiving and for whatever we do here in America. But the whole world, that's something else. We can't quite imagine right now. The nations are going to have to cooperate as never before to make sure everything is ready. All is prepared for whichever great Moed is next on the horizon. The whole world will have one eye on their work and one eye on the next Moed in a good way. I mean, not like they're stressing out. We can treat the Moedim that way, stressing out, but it's also a good thing to be looking ahead to this next festival, right? And we are told that the biggest of all of those in this future time is going to be Sukkot. And speaking of the blood of Yeshua as the basis of unity, we don't have to look very hard at the Moedim to see the blood of Yeshua at the very root of them. At the two great poles of the calendar, Passover on one side and the fall Moedim on the other, what is at the center of the story? It is the blood of the Lamb on the doorways at Passover, and it is the blood that is presented in the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. And we also find this blood sprinkled on the people at Shavuot. The foundation of the great unity the nations will experience one day is the life, death, resurrection, and return of Yeshua. And all of that is encapsulated in the blood. So lastly on this point, a verse jumped out at me this time that I hadn't really noticed before. It's Exodus 34:24. For I will cast out nations before you and enlarge your borders. No one shall covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God three times in the year. Okay, no one will want to attack Israel to take their land if they honor the pilgrimage festivals. And so there are a couple ways to understand this verse and this idea, both of which I think are true. One is that when they actually leave their homes, they're all heading to Jerusalem, leaving their cities less protected, God will make sure a neighbor doesn't attack during those times. They won't covet the land. But the other way to read it is that if you keep doing this, if you keep honoring these pilgrimage festivals, God will never allow surrounding nations to covet your land, whether they're in the middle of a trip or not. What is the image of a powerful nation that others don't want to attack? It is a unified nation. A unified nation is one that I don't want to attack, right? A nation standing together is strong. And as the people come together, according to God's sacred appointed times, they are fused into oneness. They are united. And no one's going to look at them and say, I can attack that country and succeed. Another connection between this time of year and the Torah portion is the higher state of intimacy. And we're moving on from unity here. But really not. We're talking about a higher state of intimacy that we see here in God's interaction with Moses, revealing himself when he places Moses in the cleft of the rock and declares his name through the statement known as the 13 attributes of mercy. As a marriage matures, right, we're talking about the end of the calendar here, as the marriage matures, if it's a healthy marriage, the level of intimacy should be steadily increasing as the two are knitted more and more together. These chapters are still early in God's relationship with Israel. And Israel in general has actually just sinned and separated herself from God. But we're seeing a picture here through Moses of the kind of intimacy God desires with his bride. And so it's meaningful that we're seeing this picture at this time of year, when we read this Torah portion near the maturity of Purim. I love verse 5 in chapter 34. The NASB reads, "The Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him, Moses, as he called upon the name of the Lord." God came down and stood there with Moses. You almost picture them standing next to each other watching the sunset from the top of Mount Sinai, right? One arm around the other. I'm sure it wasn't like that, since Moses is only allowed to see the back of God. I mean, this is kind of a life or death thing. But I like the way the image, you know, this verse conjures up for me anyway. God came down and stood with Moses. One thing I want to point out here, though, is what prompts this moment between God and Moses. So what prompts Moses to even ask for a deeper revelation of God? It's the darkness of the golden calf. Moses is interceding for the people, and he's seeing how difficult it is going to be to lead the people, and he says, look, I can't do this. Draw me closer to you. Help me to know you better, and then I can, you know, succeed. Then I can do it. In other words, here we have a glowing example of the general idea of Purim, which is the light emerging from the darkness, revelation emerging from hiddenness. The golden calf leads to this revelation with Moses, the 13 attributes of mercy. In the last teaching, we said that the darkness is the necessary context for bringing out the light. We simply don't reach for God with the passion he desires when our lives are full of cakes and cappuccinos. It's when we're facing that diagnosis from the doctor, when we're confronting the loss of a dream we've worked hard for, when we're coming to terms with brokenness in our relationships with others. It's when we're in the darkness that we reach out to him with passion and say, show me yourself. I trust you. I'm walking with you, but help me to walk even more closely with you. If there was no golden calf, there would be no revelation of the 13 attributes of mercy. And so this is another example, again, of that central aspect of Purim and the spiritual season in general, the bringing forth of the light from the darkness. It's at this time of year that we're reading about one of the greatest falls into darkness, followed immediately by one of the greatest lights the world has ever seen, this revelation to Moses. On the one hand, drawing the light out of the darkness is something God does, but on the other hand, he wants us to learn how to do that too, with his help. He wants us to have a role and bringing forth the light out of the darkness, this fundamental act of creation. He wants us to grow up, to learn how to create as he creates. And this light from the darkness is presented to us as his first act of creation in Genesis 1. And it's important that his first act is drawing light out of darkness. It's the first thing we see happening in the entire Bible. It's the seed of the Bible. So if we look carefully at the Word, at the Bible, and the world, we will see that first God brings light out of darkness, and then he helps mankind to do the same thing. God shines a light, and then he brings a darkness for mankind, and in the context of that darkness, he helps mankind to reflect that first light that he gave. And so let me say that again. He shines a light, he brings a darkness for mankind, and then mankind reflects that first light back to him. So we see this story play out every day. It's the story of a day. The sun shines, and then comes the darkness, and in that darkness, eventually the moon rises, and the moon reflects the light of the sun. So I think it's just amazing, just the picture that God gives us. He gives it to us in the day. He gives it to us in just everywhere we look. We need the darkness so that the reflected light can be seen and appreciated. The full moon on a dark night speaks much to the human soul. right? You can't help but see that full moon and it's dark and it just does something inside of you. I'm going to say that that is an evangelistic moment. It's an evangelistic moment. This concept is not only a main key for understanding Purim and this time of year, but it's also alluded to in our Torah portion. Do we really need to know that Moses' face glowed after he would talk with God? I mean, it's an interesting detail. I love the fact that it's in there. I like picturing that. But I don't really see the Torah giving us details just because they're interesting. There's deep meaning in the fact that Moses was reflecting the light of God. That's a picture of what all of us are supposed to be doing as the bride who is connected to the moon with the chance of fertility each month. We can also find this idea in the Torah portion in the name Bezalel, the one given special skill to craft the tabernacle. His name means in the shadow of God. So on the one hand, this can mean in the likeness of God, the idea of being a reflection of God. And on the other hand, it can literally mean Bezalel is standing in God's shadow. If he's standing in God's shadow, then he has just the right context of the darkness that comes forth from God, within which he can shine forth the image of God. Bezalel is a creator. He creates the earthly tent that is a reflection of the heavenly tent. There's just all kinds of reflecting going on in the Torah portion. It's really everywhere in the Word. If we look carefully, we can see this first light followed by the darkness and the reflected light in many places and in many scales. No matter how you cut the Bible, you will see the same pattern. If we take just the first five books, we can see that the first three, especially, right, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, they deal with God shining the light, God being very active and strong to first bring light out of the darkness and then call Abram out of the darkness of paganism, and then with a strong arm bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. And then he pours out the light of his Torah, right? And that takes us to Numbers, the fourth book. So God is being very strong, very active to shine his light in the first three books. But with Numbers, we see a shift relative to the first three books. So keep in mind that these nuances are all relative based on our Zoom level. So within the context of the Torah, Numbers is God bringing a kind of darkness, the dark context that mankind will need to reflect his light. So the Hebrew name for Numbers is Bamidbar, and you can hear the word Midbar there, which means wilderness. Bamidbar means in the wilderness, and the wilderness is known Hebraically as the dying place. It's a place of great danger from the blasting sun and lack of water and all kinds of venomous crawling things and large predators too. There's a cleansing happening here. The dying of a generation raised in Egypt. And so the darkness that God brings is connected first to cleansing. But then the darkness is connected to the coming forth of the light. God brings his dark context for us, cleansing first, bringing forth the light, the reflection. The book of Deuteronomy, the last book, is where we see the light beginning to reflect from mankind. Deuteronomy is considered the beginning of the oral law. It is Moses' restatement of the Torah. So let me say that another way. Deuteronomy is mankind's first reflection of the light of the Torah. So it's a beautiful thing to see. And if we zoom out to include the book of Joshua, the sixth book of the Bible, we see in that zoomed out context that Joshua even more strongly pictures first the cleansing darkness followed by the reflected light of mankind. And we'll get into that a little bit in a minute. But before we go there, I want to point out this pattern of light and reflected light in one other place in the Bible. If we zoom out to the level of the whole Bible, we can say that we have two main sections, the Tanakh, which we sometimes call the Old Testament, which isn't the best wording, and the Apostolic Scriptures, which we sometimes call the New Testament. So the Tanakh is the sun, and the Apostolic Scriptures are the moon. In between the two, there's a dark period that we call the intertestamental period, where there was no prophecy and no scripture. There's a reason that the Tanakh is in Hebrew and the Brit Hadashah, another way to say the New Testament, is in Greek. This is meant to be. What we're seeing in the Greek is a reflected light that's a bit dimmer, but has a grounding in physicality that is a part of God's plan. The Apostolic Scriptures are filled with Yeshua's guidance, his example and his words for applying Torah properly to all areas of mundane life, the nitty-gritty of life. Eventually, the story becomes filled with specific details in the form of letters to certain churches, with people being addressed by name, and a lot of travel plans. We went to this city, and this city, and this city, and this city. It's just a lot of details there. We should hear in all these details the echo of all the physical details in Esther and the physical details concerning the tabernacle we read at this time of year. At the end of the Bible, we see an expression of deep physicality in the service of deep spirituality. And this is how mankind reflects God's light. We reflect his light by fully inhabiting the physical vessels he gave us to inhabit. And we put those vessels to good use, to spiritual use. That's how we climb spiritually. That's how we transcend spiritually. We do it through the physical and entering it into all those details. There's much to say here about this topic. There's so much more to say. But the last point I want to make here, connecting the Apostolic Scriptures to the reflected light, is that the first chapter of the first book of the Apostolic Scriptures points us to the waxing and waning of the moon. This is something Grant has taught us. Matthew begins with the genealogy of Yeshua, and that genealogy finishes like this. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. Well, why do we need to know that? Grant has observed that 14 is half a lunar cycle, right? A lunar month is 28, 29 days. Matthew is putting the history of humanity leading up to Yeshua's birth in terms of the moon, the waxing and waning of the moon. From the early darkness of Abraham's time, right? God wasn't known very much on the earth during that time. So from that dark time of Abraham to the bright light of King David and the kingdom of God in the land, that's half a lunar cycle, right? It takes half the lunar cycle to go from darkness to light, the full moon. From the brightness of King David to the darkness of Babylonian exile, that's half a lunar cycle. If this is how the Apostolic Scriptures begin, then this idea is critical for understanding the deeper nature of what follows in the whole of the Brit Hadashah. This section of Scripture that we sometimes call the New Testament is especially connected to the moon. It's fascinating. It's fascinating the many ways that God is speaking out these messages to us. It's just every time I see a new thing, it just amazes me. So let's turn now to Joshua 12, which is basically a listing of all the kings defeated under Moses and Joshua. Under Moses, two very powerful kings east of the Jordan are crushed. And under Joshua, 31 kings west of the Jordan are destroyed, for a total of 33. And I'd like to use, you know, this last bit of time remaining here to do something of a summary of the overall connection we've been making between the calendar and the book of Joshua. so that we can see how Joshua continues this movement toward mankind reflecting God's light. So in the pattern of salvation, there are two halves. And we see these two halves in the calendar. We can call them summer or the summer side, right? Spring to fall. And the other side is winter, fall back to spring. The summer side is about rebirth and childhood and adolescence. The winter half is about adulthood and marriage. If we zoom in on the second half, just the winter side, we see two main steps there, right? We've got summer, and then we've got two steps in the winter, divided exactly in half with the winter solstice at Hanukkah. So we can call those two steps on the winter side, we can call those Hanukkah and Purim. Hanukkah has a lot to do with battle and cleansing, right? They have to clean the land from the Greeks, and they have to cleanse the temple from the impurities that the Greeks have introduced there at the temple. So it's during the cleansing of the temple that we see the miracle of the menorah happening. Purim has a lot to do with putting that cleansed vessel to use. So there's the cleansing aspect to the darkness that comes first. Then there comes the putting to use of that cleansed vessel, and we see that in Purim. So I'm ignoring a lot of other connections here, but in general, like I said, step one, cleansing the place. Step two, fully inhabiting that vessel. Really, the Spirit can flow into the vessel when it's clean. Flows from your inside out into the vessel when that vessel is clean, and then we go ahead and start using the vessel for transcendent good purposes. And so in the winter, we cleanse and inhabit. We cleanse and put to use. Now, how does Joshua fit into that picture? And so I'll do this quickly. If you lose the thread, don't worry. It'll be over soon. So if we widen out our perspective to put Joshua alongside the first five books of the Torah, Joshua clearly carries the characteristics of winter. And it does that even more than Numbers and Deuteronomy do, like we just looked at, although those do as well. It's a relative thing. Within this framework of the bigger zoom out, the Torah tells the first half of Israel's salvation story, and Joshua tells the second half. The Torah ends with Israel standing on the east side of the Jordan, ready to cross over into the land, and Joshua picks up from there. And interestingly, in the same way that the winter, right, we're saying Joshua is the winter, in the same way that the winter has the two main holidays of Hanukkah and Purim, Joshua can easily be divided exactly in half, in two. Joshua divides into the first 12 chapters and then the second 12 chapters. And we can say the first 12 are like Hanukkah and the second 12 are like Purim. In the same way that Hanukkah is about battle and cleansing, the first half of Joshua is about battle for and cleansing of the land, the purification of the vessel. And just like Purim has a very deeply physical context from which the spiritual light emerges, Purim is very physical, and the light is coming out of that. God is very hidden. There's a deep darkness there. The second half of Joshua is about settling into the darkness of the physical land, dividing it up into portions for the tribes, inhabiting the cities, inhabiting the homes. The point of this descent into physicality is so that the spiritual light can shine out from that place, from that land. What a light to the nations Israel is meant to be in that physical place. A God-fearing, Torah-loving kingdom in the middle of the planet where they treat each other as brothers and sisters, where they look out for each other and establish each other and steady each other. That's the light that emerges from the darkness. And we see that start to happen in the second half of Joshua when they are apportioned their territories and settle into their land. So this list of 33 defeated kings in Joshua 12 puts a kind of capstone on the first half of Joshua. It's maybe the Bible's way of throwing a little party. It's Joshua's and Israel's chance to look back at how far they have come with God's help. God had promised this. And in this week's Torah portion, right, in Ki Tisa, God describes how enormous of a miracle this conquering of Canaan is. This is what God says about this inheriting of the land in Exodus 34, right after he reveals himself to Moses. He says, "Behold, I am making a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels, such as have not been created in all the earth or in any nation. And all the people among whom you shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites." These are all peoples who have been rooting themselves in the land for centuries upon centuries. There were giants among them. There were allegiances among them. They grew up on that land and knew every cave and every spring. Yet God empowered Israel to demolish them. And he does the same with us. We might look at a giant in our physical flesh, in our vessel, and say, "God, that thing has been there for longer than I can remember. It is rooted there, even if it is a squatter and it shouldn't be there. It knows the territory better than I do at this point, and it has outsmarted me for decades. It's 10 feet tall and has 12 fingers and 12 toes. I can't stand up to that thing. Impossible." And God says, "I did it for Israel when they came up out of Egypt and in faith crossed into Canaan, and I will do it for you too. Just go down to the brook, get you 5 little stones, and march right out to meet that giant and watch him fall. When I'm on your side, we're not playing by the natural rules. You might be little compared to that giant, but there's a very big God standing behind you." Well, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. May God make us a people who use the darkness and struggles of life to seek God's face, to ask to know him better. May we be people who value community connections and seek to strengthen each other in community. May we search for his clever hiding places and delight in him when we find him there. May we refuse to cower in front of the giants in the flesh, but instead focus on the God who stands with us on the battlefield. And may he make us into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.